Welcome back to the deep dive. You know, it's amazing how often the topic of taxes comes up, right? It feels like it's always on everyone's mind.
Well, it's something that impacts all of us every single day.
Absolutely. And you, our listeners, specifically asked us to really dig into the U.S. tax system.
And to guide this deep dive, you've even provided some excerpts from an economics textbook, which is super helpful.
It is. So get ready, folks. We're about to unpack how much the American tax system has changed over time, how it stacks up against other countries, and maybe even uncover some surprising facts along the way.
It's pretty fascinating to see how much it's actually transformed, you know? I mean, back in 1902, get this, the government only collected about 7% of total income in taxes.
Wow, 7%. Seriously, that's a world away from what we're used to today.
Right, and today, it's almost 30%.
Right.
So what happened? Well, as the government's role expanded, so did its need for revenue.
Makes sense. I mean, think about all the services we rely on. Schools, roads, healthcare, defense.
Exactly. All of those need funding to function. It's not free.
True. But even though taxes have gone up in the U.S., our overall tax burden is still lower than in many other developed countries, isn't it?
That's right. When you look at Figure 2 in this textbook, it shows that many European countries have tax burdens that exceed like 40% of their national income.
Wow. So what are they doing with all that extra tax revenue?
Well, they often fund more extensive social safety nets and more comprehensive public services.
Interesting. So it makes you wonder, are we getting a good deal here in the U.S.?
No, that's a question worth considering. It's not just about how much we pay in taxes, but what we get back in return for those tax dollars.
Right. Value for our money. Okay, so let's zoom in on the federal tax system and see where all those dollars are coming from.
Well, the textbook lays it out pretty clearly in Table 1. It shows that personal income taxes make up the biggest chunk of federal revenue.
Yeah, personal income taxes, that's what keeps the government running, right?
Pretty much. And in 2017, it amounted to almost $5,000 per person.
$5,000 per person? That's a lot of money. No wonder we dread tax season every year.
Right. But personal income taxes aren't the only source, of course. The next biggest chunk comes from social insurance taxes, also known as payroll taxes.
Oh, yeah. Payroll taxes. That's what funds Social Security and Medicare, right?
Exactly. And in 2017, those totaled close to $4,000 per person.
Okay, so that's personal income taxes, payroll taxes. What else is there?
Then we have corporate income taxes, which are levied on business profits.
Right, corporate taxes. They don't get as much attention as personal income taxes, but they're still a significant source of revenue.
Absolutely. And we can't forget all those other smaller taxes that add up.
Like what?
Like excise taxes on things like gas and cigarettes.
Oh, right. Excise taxes.
And tariffs.
And state taxes.
Exactly. And all those other miscellaneous taxes. Individually, they might seem small, but together they generate a pretty substantial amount of revenue.
I guess it all adds up. Okay, so we've got this mix of taxes that make up the federal revenue pie. But I've always been a bit confused about double taxation. What exactly is that all about?
Double taxation? Well, imagine getting taxed twice on the same income. That's basically what happens with corporate profits.
Wait, so how does that work?
So first, the corporation pays taxes on its profits, right? But then, when those profits are distributed to shareholders as dividends, those dividends are taxed again.
Ah, I see. So it's like the government is taking two bites of the apple.
Yeah, kind of. Now, there are ways to partially offset this double taxation, like lower tax rates on dividend income.
Okay, so it's not a complete double whammy.
Right. But it's still something to consider.
Makes sense. So we've looked at the federal level. Now, what about the taxes that hit closer to home? State and local taxes.
Ah, those are the ones we feel most directly, right?
They are. What are the big players there?
Well, let's take a look at Table 3 from the textbook. It shows that property taxes are the biggest source of revenue for state and local governments.
Property taxes, the joys of homeownership, right?
Right. And in 2017, they averaged about $1,600 per person.
Okay, that's a significant chunk of change.
It is. And these property taxes, they're based on the value of land and structures.
And that money goes towards funding essential local services, like schools, right?
Exactly. Schools, roads, infrastructure, you name it.
Okay. What about sales taxes? Those seem pretty significant, too.
Oh, absolutely. Sales taxes are another major source of revenue. In 2017, they brought in around $1,200 per person.
Wow. So every time we buy something, we're contributing to state and local coffers.
That's the idea. It's interesting to note, though, that some states actually exclude necessities, like food and clothing, from sales tax.
Really? Why is that?
It's a way to provide a bit of relief for lower-income families.
Ah, that makes sense. It's a way to make the system a little bit fairer.
Exactly. Now, besides property and sales taxes, state and local governments also collect personal and corporate income taxes.
Right, just like at the federal level.
Right. But here's the thing. The rates and structures can vary a lot from state to state.
So depending on where you live, you could end up paying a lot more or a lot less in income taxes.
That's right. And some states rely pretty heavily on funding from the federal government to help support programs like Medicaid, for instance.
So it's kind of like a redistribution of wealth from richer states to poorer states.
In a way, yeah.
Okay, so we've got a pretty good grasp of the different ways governments raise money through taxes. But now comes the big question. How do we actually design a tax system that's both efficient and fair?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? It's a question that economists and policymakers have been wrestling with for, well, forever, really.
So let's break it down. Efficiency means getting the most bang for our buck, raising revenue without causing too much damage to the economy. But what about fairness? What does a fair tax system look like?
That's where things get really interesting. It's about finding that delicate balance between these two core objectives, efficiency and equity. And that's what we'll delve into next. Welcome back to our deep dive into taxes.
Picking up right where we left off, you know, really digging into those big questions about efficiency and fairness, right?
Yeah, and I think, you know, we're shifting gears a little bit now to look at some real-world examples and some of the actual debates that are going on that really show just how complicated this whole thing can get.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one thing that really stood out to me from our last discussion was that idea of taxing consumption instead of income.
That's a debate that's been gaining some traction, you know, and for good reason, I think.
Right. And the textbook even mentioned that our current income tax system, the one we have now, can actually discourage saving, which seems a little counterintuitive, right? I mean, saving is crucial, right, for investment, for economic growth.
It is. And the logic is, you know, when you earn money, you basically have two options, right? You can spend it or you can save it. But if the government taxes the income that you save, it reduces the potential return you could earn on that savings.
So it's like, it's almost like being penalized for trying to be responsible and plan for the future.
In a way, yeah. Yeah. And you can imagine how this would be especially discouraging for, you know, for younger people who are just starting out, you know, trying to build a nest egg.
Right. Right. So how would a consumption tax change things? How would that work?
Well, with a consumption tax, you're only taxed on what you spend, not what you save.
So I could stash away as much money as I want in savings and investments,
yeah.
And I wouldn't owe any taxes on that until I actually withdraw that money and spend it.
That's the basic idea, yeah.
Yeah.
And by removing that tax penalty on saving, the thinking is that a consumption tax would encourage people to save more and invest more.
Hmm, interesting. So it's almost like a way to kind of nudge people towards making better financial decisions, right?
Yeah, that's one of the arguments in favor of it.
You know,
it's aligning the tax system with those broader economic goals of saving and investment and growth.
Okay, but wouldn't a consumption tax end up disproportionately benefiting, you know, wealthier people, because they tend to have more disposable income to save and invest in the first place, right?
That's a valid concern, absolutely, and that's one of the reasons why this debate is so complex. Because designing a consumption tax that's both efficient and equitable, it's not easy.
Yeah, I can see how that would be tricky. So what are some of the ways that a consumption tax could actually be implemented? Like, what are the different approaches?
Well, one popular approach is something called a value-added tax, or VAT, which is widely used in Europe.
Right, a textbook mentioned that, VAT, yeah. How exactly does that work?
So think of it like a sales tax, but instead of collecting the tax only at the final point of sale, it's collected in stages throughout the production process.
So at each stage, a business pays tax on the value that they add to the product.
Precisely, yeah. And because the VAT is built into the price at each stage, it's often less visible to consumers than a traditional sales tax.
I see. But wouldn't that make it harder for consumers to really understand how much tax they're actually paying? Like, wouldn't that lack of transparency be kind of a problem?
That's a valid point. Transparency is important, and it's something that policymakers need to consider carefully when they're designing any tax system.
Right. Okay, that makes sense. What about in the U.S.? Do you have any features that kind of resemble a consumption tax in our current system?
Right. We do, actually. You know, retirement savings plans, like 401ks and IRAs, those allow you to defer paying taxes on the contributions and the investment earnings until you withdraw the money in retirement.
So it's like a consumption tax specifically for retirement savings.
Exactly. Yeah. And there have even been discussions about expanding these types of tax advantage savings plans to encourage even more people to save.
Yeah, yeah, I can see how that could be a valuable tool for helping people achieve financial security in the long run. But let's switch gears for a minute and talk about that administrative burden that we discussed earlier. You know, all the hassle and the complexity that comes with dealing with taxes.
Yes, the paperwork and the regulations that make tax season such a headache for so many people.
Right, and the textbook made a good point that simplifying the tax code could help ease this burden, but that's obviously easier said than done.
It is. There are often strong political forces that resist change, even when simplification would benefit most taxpayers.
Right. I guess everyone loves a good loophole that benefits them, but nobody wants to be the one to give up their own special treatment.
It's a classic collective action problem. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But there are definitely areas where streamlining could make the system more efficient, more user friendly.
Imagine, you know, a world where filing taxes was as simple as filling out a postcard, right? Wouldn't that be amazing?
It certainly would. It certainly would. And, you know, technology is opening up some exciting possibilities for automating and simplifying many aspects of tax compliance. So, you know, who knows? Maybe someday that postcard dream will become a reality.
I hope so. Okay, so we've covered some big picture policy questions. Now, I'd love to get into a specific example that really highlights all this this complexity. And I think the corporate income tax is a perfect one to focus on because there's always so much debate surrounding it.
The corporate income tax is a great example because it really illustrates how understanding tax incidents is key, right?
It's
key to evaluating both fairness and efficiency. And remember, tax incidents refers to who actually bears the burden of a tax.
And as we've seen, it's not always, you know, as straightforward as it might seem.
Exactly. So the textbook uses this this example of the government raising the tax on car companies.
Right.
And on the surface, it might seem like the car companies are the ones, you know, footing the bill.
Right. But we saw how that seemingly simple change could ripple through the entire system, impacting not only the car companies, but also workers and consumers.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, owners of car companies, they might react by, you know, investing less in new factories, for instance.
Right. And that could lead to less production and potentially higher prices for consumers.
Exactly. And with fewer factories being built, the demand for auto workers could go down, potentially leading to lower wages or even job losses.
Right. So even though the tax is levied on corporations, the burden could actually end up being shared by workers and consumers.
That's exactly right. It's a reminder that we can't just look at the immediate impact of a tax, you know, who's writing the check to the government. We have to consider those broader economic effects to really understand who's actually paying the price.
Right. And the textbook also mentioned the 2017 tax bill, which significantly lowered the corporate tax rate.
Oh, yeah, that was a big change. And it generated a lot of discussion, you know, with people arguing both for and against it.
Exactly. Proponents argue that the lower rate would stimulate, you know, investment, boost economic growth, lead to higher wages for workers.
Right. While critics argued that the benefits would mostly go to wealthy shareholders and have little impact on the average worker.
Hmm. It's a complex issue, and it seems like there's no easy answer there.
There isn't. But one thing that is clear is that analyzing tax incidents is crucial when we're trying to evaluate the effects of any corporate tax policy.
It really underscores how interconnected the economy is, right? Even changes that seem like they're targeted at one group can have these widespread consequences.
Absolutely. Now, I want to circle back to horizontal equity, which is that idea that people with similar abilities to pay should contribute the same amount in taxes.
Right, we touched on that briefly earlier, but it's worth exploring a little further. And it sounds simple in theory, but as we saw with that example of of the Garcia and Jackson families from the textbook, you know, applying this concept in the real world can get pretty messy.
It can. It's hard to define, you know, what similar actually means when families have so many different situations, you know, income levels, number of dependents, healthcare expenses, education costs, the list goes on.
Right. And that's where the U.S. tax code gets really interesting, you know, with all its special provisions and deductions and exemptions, you know, trying to take all these different circumstances into account.
Right. It's a constant struggle, you know, to strike that balance. You know, how do you create a system that's fair without overcomplicating the tax code or creating loopholes that people can, you know, exploit?
Yeah, it's tough. And the textbook gave a good example of this balancing act with the deductibility of interest payments, right? The Tax Reform Act of 1986 eliminated the deduction for interest on things like credit cards and car loans.
Right, but it kept the deduction for mortgage interest.
Right. And that was a deliberate policy choice aimed at encouraging home ownership.
It was. But it also created a situation where, from a tax perspective, you know, buying a home was more advantageous than other forms of borrowing, even if those other forms might, you know, make more financial sense for an individual.
Right. So it's a classic example of how a policy that's designed to encourage a certain behavior can also create these unintended consequences.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
And it shows that policymakers really have to weigh the costs and the benefits, you know, carefully, recognizing that there are always trade-offs involved.
Always trade-offs. Okay, let's get back to tax incidents for a moment. You know, that fur coat tax example from the textbook, that was a great illustration of how the burden of a tax doesn't always fall where you might expect it to.
Oh yeah, that was a good one. It really debunked that flypaper theory, right? Which assumes that the burden just sticks wherever it first lands.
Right. So if people who buy fur coats can easily switch to other, you know, luxury goods, then a tax on those coats might just lead to fewer sales.
Right. And the burden then shifts to the producers and the workers.
So instead of impacting wealthy consumers, the tax could end up hurting people who are less well off.
It could. It's a classic example of why we can't just, you know, look at who's writing the check to the government. Right. We need to analyze the bigger picture to understand who's truly bearing the cost.
Right. It's another reminder that economic policies, even those that seem, you know, relatively simple, can have these far-reaching and sometimes unintended consequences.
They can. Now, let's revisit that distinction between marginal and average tax rates again. It's a concept that often trips people up.
I know I struggled with it at first, but that pizza example you gave earlier, that helped a lot. You know, it's important to remember that the average tax rate just tells you your overall tax burden, but it's the marginal rate that affects your decisions at the margin, so to speak.
Exactly. Yeah. So when you're deciding whether to, you know, to work an extra shift or take on a side project or something like that, it's your marginal tax rate, you know, the rate on that additional income that matters most.
Right. So a high marginal rate might actually discourage people from pursuing opportunities to earn extra income because they know that a larger chunk of that income is going to go to taxes.
Precisely, yeah. And that's why understanding the difference between these two rates is so crucial when we're analyzing how taxes shape behavior and potentially even lead to, you know, to dead weight loss. Okay, I think I finally got a solid grasp on those concepts now. Mm-hmm. Now I'm curious to learn about other perspectives on tax policy. Mm-hmm. You know, the textbook focused on the benefits principle and the ability to pay principle, but are there other viewpoints out there?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Those two principles are, you know, they're often seen as the foundation of tax equity, but there are other frameworks for thinking about fairness and effectiveness in a tax system.
Can you give us an example?
Sure. One idea that's been gaining some traction is taxing wealth instead of income.
Taxing wealth. So instead of just taxing what people earn, you would also tax their assets, like property and investments. Exactly. Yeah. So proponents of this approach argue that it's a more direct way to address you know, income inequality and raise revenue from those who have accumulated the most wealth.
Yeah, I can see why that would appeal to people who believe that, you know, that the super rich aren't contributing enough.
Right. But it's important to note that wealth taxes also come with their own set of challenges.
Like what kind of challenges?
Well, one concern is that they could discourage investment and entrepreneurship. People might be, you know, less likely to take risks if they know that they'll be taxed on their accumulated wealth, even if their investments haven't generated any income yet.
Right. That makes sense. And I imagine it would be pretty tricky to actually determine the value of certain assets, right? Like art or privately held businesses.
You're absolutely right. You know, valuing those types of assets can be very, very subjective, and it could lead to disputes and all sorts of complications.
So while the idea of taxing wealth is, you know, is interesting, actually putting it into practice in a fair and efficient way would be incredibly difficult.
It would be. It's a reminder that there are no easy answers when it comes to tax policy. You know, there are always trade-offs to consider.
It seems like every solution has its own set of trade-offs and potential drawbacks.
It does, and that's why it's such a fascinating and complex topic. You know, tax policy is inherently political because it involves, you know, distributing burdens and benefits among different groups in society.
Right. And there will always be, you know, disagreements about what's fair and what's not, what works and what doesn't.
There will be. Okay. Yeah. But that's what makes it so important to engage in these discussions and understand the various perspectives.
This deep dive has been really eye-opening for me. You know, I feel like I'm finally starting to appreciate just how intricate and nuanced the whole world of tax design really is.
And we've only just scratched the surface.
I know. There's so much more to explore.
There is. But as we wrap up this part of our exploration, you know, let's take a moment to kind of recap some of the key insights that we've uncovered.
Okay, yeah. You know, one of the biggest takeaways for me was that idea of taxing consumption instead of income. It was fascinating to learn how that approach could potentially boost, you know, saving and investment, although there are definitely concerns about fairness and how to implement it effectively.
Right. And we also delved a bit deeper into that concept of tax incidence using examples like the corporate income tax and the FERC code tax to illustrate how the burden of a tax can actually shift in these unexpected ways.
Yeah, I really emphasized the importance of, you know, of looking beyond who initially pays the tax and considering those broader economic ripple effects.
Absolutely. And we revisited that distinction between marginal and average tax rates as well, you know, clarifying how each rate plays a different role in shaping behavior and economic outcomes.
Right. And we touched on some alternative philosophies of taxation, you know, like that concept of taxing wealth, you know, recognizing that there are many, many different viewpoints out there on how to achieve a fair and efficient system.
There are. And it's those different viewpoints that we're going to explore in the next part of this deep dive and hopefully tie everything together for you all at home.
Okay, great. I'm looking forward to it. Welcome back to the deep dive.
We're in the final stretch now of our exploration of the U.S. tax system.
I know, it's gone by so fast. And we've covered a lot of ground, haven't we? From the history of taxes to all those complexities of fairness and efficiency.
We have. And, you know, those textbook excerpts that you provided have been super helpful in really dissecting those key concepts.
They really have. But, you know, as with any good deep dive, it's not just about, you know, reaching the bottom.
No, it's not about just getting to the end.
It's about the journey, you know,
yeah.
The insights we gather along the way and how those insights change our perspective.
It's about challenging those assumptions.
Exactly. So as we wrap up, let's take a moment to kind of reflect on those key takeaways and maybe leave you with some food for thought.
Some things to ponder. Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely. You know, one of the biggest lessons I think that we've learned is that, you know, there's no such thing as a perfect tax system.
There isn't.
Yeah.
And that's something that, you know, a lot of people don't realize.
Right. Every decision involves these trade-offs.
Yeah.
You know, we might aim for a system that's incredibly efficient, but achieving that might mean sacrificing some fairness along the way.
Right. Or vice versa.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
A system that prioritizes equity above all else, well, that could end up being less efficient.
It's all about finding that sweet spot, right?
It is. And where that balance ultimately lands really depends on what we as a society, you know, value most.
Right. And the textbook highlighted this tension really well when it discussed the history of U.S. tax policy.
I think it did.
You know, we saw how different presidential administrations, you know, from Reagan to Clinton to Bush to Obama to Trump, you know, they all grappled with this very issue.
They did. And they each enacted policies that reflected their own, you know, their own views on the optimal balance between efficiency and equity.
Right. And that's a good reminder that, you know, tax policy isn't static, right? It's constantly evolving in response to changing economic conditions, societal needs and political priorities.
It's a dynamic process that we all have a stake in, you know,
yeah.
as taxpayers, as citizens, as participants in this economy.
Absolutely. And that's why it's so important to stay informed and engage, right?
It is mm-hmm. because understanding those, you know, those basic principles of economics, it gives us the tools to make more informed decisions about the policies that shape our lives.
It really does. You know, it empowers us to advocate for the changes we believe in and to hold our elected officials accountable.
Exactly. Yeah.
So as we conclude this deep dive, let's leave you with a few questions to ponder to kind of continue the conversation at home, so to speak.
Right. Keep the discussion going.
Yeah. What aspects of the U.S. tax system do you find to be the most fair or the most unfair?
Yeah. And what resonates with you? You know,
yeah.
does the benefits principle, you know, or the ability to pay principle resonate more strongly with you?
Right. And how do your own, you know, views on tax fairness align with the current tax policies in place?
And maybe most importantly, you know, what role do you want to play in shaping the future of the U.S. tax system?
Right. Because this is an ongoing conversation.
Yeah.
You know, it's a
yeah.
debate that's constantly evolving.
It is.
So stay informed, engage with the issues and make your voice heard.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the U.S. tax system.
Yeah, thanks for diving deep with us.
We hope this exploration has given you a new perspective on this complex and fascinating topic.
It really is a fascinating topic.
And we'll be here for your next deep dive, you know, ready to help you navigate those intriguing questions that keep you up at night.
Those late night thoughts.
Until then. Keep exploring, keep learning, and keep diving deep.
Keep diving deep, everybody.